Wabanaki Heritage, part of our series on Maine history. This year, in commemoration of Maine's bicentennial, we are looking back at Maine history. And today, we look back much farther than 200 years. That's because Indigenous people have been on this land for thousands of years. Today, they are known as the Wabanaki, with four federally recognized tribes: Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What do we know about the earliest people to live here? How did the Wabanaki nations come to be? How did they adapt and survive the arrival of Europeans in the 1500s? And what have they faced in the 200 years that Maine has been a state? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. The presence of Indigenous people in Maine goes back before recorded history. Today, we're going to talk about some of that tribal history, and this is part of our series of history programs marking Maine's bicentennial. My guest, Donald Soctoma, who is historian and director of cultural resources for the Passamaquoddy tribe, and Chris Newell, who is executive director of the Abbey Museum and senior partner to Wabanaki Nations. We invite your questions and comments. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both so much for being here today. Donald Soctoma, I will start with you. We understand that the glaciers retreated from this land about 12,000 years ago. What do we know about the arrival of peoples at that time? Who were they? Where did they come from? And what do we know and what do we not know?
Good morning, and good morning to everybody. The glacier, the time frame of the glacier, has always been debated. When I was in high school, they talked about the glacier 6,000, 8,000, 10,000, and now they say 12,000. So, you know, that's a date that really, I don't think really matters. It might be more like 20,000. People, for me personally, Wabanaki have always been on this land. People today live on the glacier up in up north in the Alaska region, and so people survived on the glacier, on the edge of the glacier. That's what I've always been taught, is that we have always been here. And that's a debate that we've always had with historians and archaeologists. So people lived here, for me, since time immemorial.
Are the people that were here thousands of years ago your direct ancestors?
Yes. Like I said, Wabanaki have always been here. It goes back 1,000 generations, you know, according to our stories that have been passed on from generation to generation. We've always been here.
Chris Newell, bringing you into the conversation. We use the term Wabanaki today. Tell us about the derivation of the term. I understand it to be people of the dawn. Is that accurate? Is that an accurate definition of what the word means, and how the group of tribes and the group of people who live in what is now Maine and Eastern Canada came to be called Wabanaki or Abenaki?
So, yeah, that's a great question. Amongst the different Wabanaki nations, it would be pronounced differently. And the version that we're using right now, Wabanaki, is really more the anglicized version, although some of the tribal dialects do pronounce it more closer to that. From what I've been told and taught, you know, by folks like Roger Paul, Wabanakiik is more the term we would use in Passamaquoddy. And it's really the term that goes back to our story of creation. When Glooskap created the first Wabanaki man and woman, the first man and woman here out of the ash trees, he named us that. The people of the place where the sun first looks our way is kind of how the language would break it down. But we translate it to English to English speakers as people of the dawn, because that's what we're getting at, is that it's really people of the dawn land, the geographical area where the sun first hits the shores of this continent here. So we understood, our ancestors understood very well their geographical nature, and part of our cosmology is an understanding that we have a duty to sing the sunrise up every morning so that the rest of the country gets sunrise every sunlight every day.
Donald, tell me how your people lived for years. Maine is cold and it's harsh, and how did people survive this environment before we had any modern amenities?
People became part of the land. They were able to read the weather, understand the animals, the migration patterns of the animals, and always know where to be at the right place. Places to be out of the wind, out of the blizzards. Today people live up in pretty close to the North Pole, and they adapt. That's part of them. The weather's part of them. They're just able to survive what they were taught.
And I understand people were, they had a seasonal movement, that the people spent different times of the year in different parts of the state.
Yes, you follow the seasons. If the caribou herds are up in the deep woods or on the areas that they like to winter, you're going to be there for hunting. If the salmon are running in the springtime, you're going to be at the first waterfalls. It only makes sense, if you want to survive, you got to go where there's game, food for your family and for the rest of the people.
And when people did that, when they moved seasonally, where did they live? What was the shelter like as the people moved from place to place? Was it temporary? Was there a place that they returned to in between that had more stable living quarters?
In the early days, the home was a wigwam. It could be the triangle shape. It could be the dome shape. And just go to places and travel places where you can survive.
Chris Newell, I want to ask you if you can tell me about the four tribes that we are now federally recognized in Maine, and how each is defined from one another, and what the names mean. Just give us a little bit of history of each of the four tribes, if you could.
Sure. I mean, I first want to mention that Wabanaki peoples extend far beyond the colonial borders of the state of Maine, and that would include our Abenaki relatives out to the west of us, as Wabanaki peoples as well. But for the four federally recognized tribes in the state of Maine, we have the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, and Mi'kmaq is the preferred term they choose these days, although the Rustic Band of Mi'kmaq still use once again, anglicized terminology, Mi'kmaq. And the Maliseet peoples, and those English names the anglicized names don't accurately describe who we are and where we come from. Passamaquoddy comes from our language Beskidamukadig, which is the people of the who spear pollock, or the people of the place where we spear pollock, which describes accurately our seasonal migration to the mouth of Scudig, or the St. Croix River, and the pollock runs that would have there, that literally would be able to provide enough food source to be dried and cured for to get you through the entire winter. So that was an important part of our lifeways. Maliseet peoples, they would call themselves Wolastoqwihig, which which is the people of the Beautiful River, and they are the riverine culture, very, very similar language to Passamaquoddy, almost exactly the same, with some differences. And, you know, that once again refers their name for themselves. Mi'kmaq is a term. I'm not a Mi'kmaq person, so I'm not really the expert to talk about this particular term, but I hear that it's actually kind of a term that has changed over time, and the older term might have been Ni'kmaq, which is more of a description of their coastal ways. And then Banuapskeg, the Penobscot people, that describes where Indian Island is, where the river widens out. Our names are really tied to the landscape and the relational aspect that we have to the land and how we used it. And that's literally a life way that was, you know, built by Native peoples. It's a big misnomer that the land was wilderness or uncared for. Native peoples, Wabanaki peoples as well, took care of the landscape, used the landscape, and by doing so, actually increased the productivity of it. So that back colonization, there was actually so much food. The codfish that were here were said to be, you know, would number so much that you could walk across some of the bays on the backs of them. And that's some of the secrets of history, is that early Portuguese and fishermen from Europe were coming here as early as the 15th century to fish for the very high stock, high quality codfish to bring back to Europe. So contact was actually happening back in those days. It just wasn't being recorded. But our people are we're tied to the land, and all of the names that we use for our collective four tribes today are the anglicized versions of the tribal terms that actually talk about our relationship to the land.
Donald, what do we know about the relationship between the tribes with one another back, you know, before colonization? Did the tribes trade with one another? Did they fight with one another? What do we know?
Trading is a big part of our culture. We travel to the southern tribes along the southern part of Maine to trade for crops, because they were pretty much the farmers, and us up north with the hunters, pretty much we'd be hunting the caribou, the moose, and we'd go down there and trade for corn and squash. So there was a lot of trading going on. We have so many songs and stories about the act of trading. That was an important part of our culture. So people depended on that trade. If you go to some of the old village sites, they call it archaeological sites, you find stones from different parts of the country. That was brought about through trade. You'd have a visitor from, let's say, the Great Lakes, and they'd bring a special stone and maybe trade it. Or we'd travel to certain areas like... we're in Washington County, but sometimes we travel to Mount Kenyo and the Greenville area to harvest some of the rhyolite and bring it back and make fine spearheads and knives and other things.
And Chris, Donald mentioned Kineo is a trading place. I had read that. And Chris, I'd also read that right where you are, the Abbey Museum, that Bar Harbor was an important trading place.
Absolutely. There's an abundance of resources within the area. Mount Desert Island was, valued by the rusticators because of the beauty of it, but also, the beautiful resources that were available through the area as well. And it kind of is a borderland area between, Passamaquoddy, Penobscot territory, and also close to the ocean, which means that arriving ships, Europeans could come into the area. And culturally, over time, even as our tribes were forced into the market economy. Cultural continuity within Mount Desert Island remained for quite a long time, all the way through to the 19th century. There were encampments of Passamaquoddies that would come to sell baskets, and then eventually some laws, local laws, were made that eventually pushed that off into the area of Trenton. But the area has remained that cultural continuity, and it is reviving these days with, of course, the Native American Festival that's held through the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance and the College of the Atlantic, and now with the decolonization effort of the Abbey Museum and the way the governance of the Abbey Museum is now majority Wabanaki governed. So this is a revitalization that we're seeing of a very old tradition of continuity of Native peoples to the Mount Desert Island landscape.
Mm. Donald Sagtoma, we are talking about history, and you had one of you mentioned that the first traders were probably here in the 1400s. We know that became more regular in the 1500s. And I also read that the early 1600s were just horrendous for the Wabanaki people, that between the year 1616 and 1619, almost 90% died. What was that from? Was it from disease? Was it from, tell us about the arrival of the Europeans. And we know that in other parts of the country, for example, was tuberculosis. What happened in the early 1600s?
The Wabanaki had their own physical well-being that was came from our territory, and we weren't the common diseases that were brought over from Europe. We didn't have a tolerance for it because we didn't have those types of diseases here. So
right.
When the first European came, the very first one, he probably brought his own set of germs with him that was not native to this country, and it started taking effect. So the body reacts in different ways. Our medicine people that took care of the community would be able to get plants and herbs and to make medicinal potions, medicine for the community. But these were different types of diseases, like the smallpox. You know, smallpox was still in our community here at Passamaquoddy until the mid-1800s.
Mm.
So continually going through our community, and people would pick up and move to go to another place and try to get deeper and deeper into the woods away from that contact.
I had known that your people had been decimated when Europeans came, but I did not realize it was so many people in such a short period of time. How does your oral tradition remember that? Is there a name for that period? Is there are there ceremonies? Are there ways of honoring those you lost?
Well, a lot of people talk about the dying period. It's a period of when contact happened with the non-native people, that the dying started then. And then we got dragged into wars that didn't really, didn't want to be involved with, because we're pretty much a peace-loving people. And we ended up getting dragged into European wars. So it's a dying period. You overlap the diseases and the wars. And about 90%, I think you're right, of our population, sometimes whole villages were wiped out because of the smallpox and all these other types of diseases.
Mm. We're talking about Wabanaki heritage and history on Maine Calling. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. An email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Green Hut Galleries, presenting its holiday show, an annual group exhibition, December 3rd through January 30th. GreenHutGalleries.com. New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative and committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome. And the Trust for Public Land, inviting you to support their work creating parks and protecting lands with a donation at tpl.org. Maine Public continues to celebrate the first 200 years of Maine's statehood. We're sharing historical information, interesting facts, and personal recollections, both by looking back at how this great state of Maine developed and also peering ahead for the next 200 years. All of our radio and television bicentennial programming, including On This Day in Maine History and This Is My Maine, can be found again or for the first time at mainepublic.org. The Maine State Bicentennial Hub link is under the Radio, Television, or Education dropdowns. You can also find links at mainepublic.org to our bicentennial partners, including the Maine State Archives, the Maine Historical Society, and the Maine State Bicentennial Commission. Happy birthday, Maine! From bookstores to banks, restaurants to realtors, Maine Public is supported by a wide variety of businesses and organizations. They understand the importance of Maine Public in our community, and their investment helps make this service possible. More information about connecting your business with our audience is available at mainepublic.org, click on support, or you can give us a call at 800-884-1717 and ask for Dionysia Giadas. Together, we make Maine Public possible.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about the history of the Wabanaki tribes in Maine. Joining me, Chris Newell, who is executive director of the Abbey Museum, and Donald Soktoma, a historian with the Passamaquoddy tribe. Share your comments or questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to start with a tweet. Somebody asks, curious if you could recommend any good books about the Wabanaki in Maine, interested in both nonfiction and historical fiction. Chris, I'll turn to you.
There's a project that happened back in my childhood that is still in existence, and that's a resource book that was created called The Wabanaki of People in the Maritimes that I believe was funded by the American Friends Service Committee and had a lot of tribal involvement. It was one of the first attempts at creating a co-curriculum with tribal involvement, and that resource book is very old, but it still exists. And there's some, you know, pretty good information in there as well. Books written by people that, you know, of course, are from the communities themselves. So I think of my cousin Alan Saka Basin, who wrote about his life experience growing up, land claim settlement days, in the days with no electricity, no running water, and tar paper shacks. And that's a book called An Upriver Passamaquoddy, and that's one that I often recommend. And then Donald here, I'm sure, can talk about this more, but there's a terrific book that he coordinated on about the life of Thomas Joseph and his relationship to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which I believe is called Remember Me, Donald. Correct me if I'm wrong, though.
Hold on. Let me click him back in. We lost you for a second, Donald. Chris was asking you about the book Remember Me.
Yes,
are you there?
Yes, I worked with Gene Flaherty on this historical book. It was about the relationship in the early 1900s with the chief of our tribe, Joseph, a young boy that later became president of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt.
And he taught him, and you're fading out a little bit. I hope we can get that back. And he taught Roosevelt to paddle a canoe and to fish, correct?
Well, that was one of the things. He taught him about life on the Passamaquoddy Bay, on Campobello Island, about the relationships of people that
from native to non-native to understand one another.
And that book was co-authored with Jean Flahive, also a friend of this program. We're going to go to Michael, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for taking the call. And Donald, I worked with a few people from the Penobscot tribe on the Penobscot Watershed Eco Center back in the 90s. And I just wondered how things were going with the Penobscot and whether you were still involved with educating the public about the fisheries and how important that is to both the Penobscot people, but also to our ecology here in the Gulf of Maine in general.
The Penobscot River Project was really, I think it was probably one of the best programs nationwide and really set the standard for the rest of the nation to look at. Here at Passamaquoddy, we're doing work on the St. Croix, and we're using the model from the Penobscot Restoration Project. So, yes, I still travel around the state pre-COVID days. now I do phone calls, I do Zoom conferences, and but I enjoy traveling and talking to people about history.
Michael, thank you so much for calling in with your question. Joining us now, Brian Reynolds, who is from the Holton Band of Maliseets. Brian, thank you so much for calling in. You're a tribal citizen and administrator, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I am.
You work as the education director for the Maliseets. How well do you feel that people in Maine are taught about Native American history?
I don't think there's a lot of Wabanaki history being taught in schools, and there hasn't for years, but I do feel recently there's been kind of more interest. And as far as us getting more questions or calls here at our band office or from different art exhibits and so forth across the state.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you think people have?
I think one of the main misconceptions is that, the tribe somehow lost a war, therefore, we have to settle for like the Maine Indian and Lands Claim Settlement Act and what the product or outcome was of that and different jurisdictional issues and so forth and so on. People just don't really understand the history of Maine is my interpretation of it.
Oh, Brian, I'm so glad you mentioned the Settlement Act of 1980. We haven't discussed that yet on the program. So, Chris, I'm going to turn to you. For those who are not familiar, those who are too young or have recently moved to Maine, explain what the Land Claim Settlement Act is and why it's so much in the news again today.
So the Land Claim Settlement Act of 1980 was the result of a 10-year, what began as a litigation for lost land rights that were go back to the 1700s. And it was literally the largest land claims case ever in history, covering 12 and a half million acres, based off of a law passed by the first Congress of the United States called the Federal Trade and Intercourse Act. In that act, the conveyance of native land could not happen without approval of the federal government. And there was a treaty signed in Watertown, Massachusetts, or not Watertown. There was, I believe it was Watertown, maybe. It was in Massachusetts anyway. But it was signed in 1794. And in that treaty of 1794, basically the treaty signers gave up rights for opening up land for settlement for non-natives. And a lot of that was translated by the English writers of the treaty as basically a conveyance of land that we gave land to our what would become our neighbors, which became the state of Mainers. And because that law, because that treaty was signed in 1794, it was never ratified by the federal government. It was essentially an illegal conveyance of land, and therefore it put 12.5 million acres of title, much of two-thirds of the state of Maine, up in the air as far as who actually had rights of ownership to it under American law. Now, the point of the whole case, which involved the Passamaquoddies and the Penobscots at the time, was never to remove non-natives from the area, although that was part of the campaign against having sort of settlement. It was really about undoing historical wrong, and the settlement came about as a way to create settle the historic wrong, but also create hopefully a good neighbor policy with our friends and neighbors here in the state of Maine, many of whom are intermarried within our communities these days. So that's where the idea came from, to settle for these lands. Part of it was the settlement was to repurchase areas of the state that could be put in trust for the tribes. Unfortunately, there was some parts of it that were rushed at the very end, and that includes the jurisdiction language. And what we've learned over time is that the meaning of the jurisdiction language, it was told to the negotiators on the tribal side, that the language of municipalities and things of that sort that were added in there were actually grants of power on top of the tribal sovereignty of the tribes. However, in state court, ever since the Maine Implementing Act, which was the state law that went with the federal settlement act, that law ended up being interpreted under state court as limiting us to the power of municipalities. Therefore, rather than being a help to self-determination for the tribe, it has actually been a significant roadblock in every way possible. What's been happening over the last 2 years is the legislature has been working very well with the tribes to create an agreement to kind of undo the harms that the Maine Implementing Act did towards self-determination, and to once again retain sovereignty over our rights of fishing, hunting, taking care of the land, open the path to self-determination for the tribe. Now, the tribe has a history ever since the creation of the state of being wards of the state and enforced under that system of oppression for a long time. And we really, looking to our future, would rather have our own fate in our own hands. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the renegotiation with LD 2094 that's been happening in the past 2 years has been about. It's been getting to that place where we are in agreement with our neighbors. We're making good neighbor relationships with the state of Maine, but at the same time preserving our rights and allowing a path for us to take care of ourselves.
And because of COVID and the legislature adjourning early, that is really on hold right now. Really important discussions that need to resume. I wanted to have you on the phone, Brian, when we talked about this, though, because my understanding is that the Land Claim Settlement Act affects Maliseets differently than the other tribes.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, like we heard previously, there's some jurisdictional issues, and this idea that the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots are, treated like municipalities, and my, band of Maliseets was brought in kind of at the last hour, and we weren't as organized, as a tribal government. So my understanding is told to me by my elders that were around then is that, we were to get together, create our tribal government and our community and work on those things, and then go back to the state at a later date to, negotiate some of these issues about jurisdiction and hunting and fishing and all the things that follow. And that's the effort's been made on our part, I feel, to begin these conversations. However, they haven't gotten us anywhere. There's been times where we've gotten close, you know, in dealing with the state, but then it's just not happened. And like was mentioned, in the last couple of years, there's been a group of, you know, state folks and tribal leaders together working on those issues. So hopefully we can get some traction there.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining our conversation today. Brian Reynolds is a tribal administrator with the Houlton Band of Maliseet. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling, with help from New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. Freeport Wild Bird Supply, a place for bird enthusiasts for nature gifts, feeding supplies, and more. Curbside pickup and ordering at freeportwildbirdsupply.com. And Maine Community Foundation, proud to support Maine Calling, a forum for ideas and issues that matter most. MaineCF.org.
The Farragut-class destroyer USS Dewey, hull number DLG-14, was launched at Bath Iron Works on November 30, 1958. The vessel was the first U.S. Navy warship to be built from the keel up as a guided missile destroyer. The Dewey's first commanding officer was Commander Elmo R. Zumwalt, Jr., whom a class of Navy destroyers was later named. The Dewey served in the Cuban quarantine during the Cuban Missile Crisis and provided gunfire support during the Vietnam War. Following modifications, Dewey was reclassified and received the hull number DDG-45 in June 1975. The destroyer took part in recovery operations following the U.S. Space Shuttle Challenger's explosion in 1986.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Robin Young. The Black Reverend Liz Walker heard her Black community saying they didn't trust the coronavirus vaccine because of historical abuse by the medical world, so she called up Dr. Anthony Fauci to talk to them.
And I plead with you, don't deprive yourself by not getting vaccinated. Protect yourselves, your family, and your community.
Next time, here and now.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at noon right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, we are touching on the history of Native Americans in Maine. Joining me, Donald Soctoma, who's Passamaquoddy historian, and Chris Newell with the Abbey Museum. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Eileen sends an email saying we are not pronouncing Wabanaki as the natives pronounce it. She says we need to be saying wah as in a baby's cry. Chris Newell, is she right? Should we be saying Wabanaki?
In Passamaquoddy, we don't have the ah sound. We have the ah sound. So once again, the term that we use, Wabanaki, is the anglicized or English language version of what our dialects speak. And every tribe says it a little bit differently.
Okay, we'll go to Gabby, who's calling from Cornville. Hi, Gabby. Go ahead.
Debbie.
Oh, go ahead, Debbie.
Okay. When I was working on my bachelor's degree in herbal medicine, I tried to relate and use a lot of Native history to help me. And what I found was the research and the stories just brought me to tears. And so I'm wondering if your guests, Chris and Donald, can talk about the positive aspects of being Native, what has sustained us through the years, about our connection to the earth and our spiritual connections.
Donald.
Yeah, that's a good question. During the hard times when our tribes weren't allowed to speak the language, when we weren't allowed to leave the reservation, people always retreated to the woods or were able to get back in touch with nature and what we call our Native religion. That sustained us through time, knowing the function of the trees for medicine and the plants for medicine. We were able to sustain our way of life by practicing what our ancestors taught us, but continuing on in this modern world, Yeah.
Debbie, thank you for your call. A couple emails here I'm going to go to. This one from Marilyn writes, I'd be interested to learn something of the Wabanaki presence at the head of China Lake. And then Betsy, could the guests offer insights on Wabanaki living in Western Maine? So Chris, what do we know about indigenous people in the China Lake region and in Western Maine?
Oh man, I'm not the greatest person to talk on that subject. Being from Washington County myself, with Donald Soctoma, so a lot of my tribal knowledge comes from my raising along close to the Canadian border in Madoc-Miguk, as well as my family in Zibayik. But from what I understand, those communities, they are communities of people that were forced out of certain areas and found refuge within the territory there. And from what I understand, I believe that they are Maliseet, and they are likely because of the history of the way Abenakis were attacked and massacred in the state of Maine and forced into communities either out of the area as far away as Quebec or some of them taken in by the Penobscots, that there is likely some Eastern Abenaki mixed in there as well.
Okay. A tweet here. Many in the state still call people Indians, which is sad. Let me ask you that, Donald. How do you feel about the term Indian? I lived in California for a few years before I came east, and it was a term that was not used.
Yeah, to me, when somebody asked me that, I said, well, you can call me Donald. You know, I'm a person first, and then I'm a Passamaquoddy. But I think in general, it depends on the individual. You know, for me, Native American, Indian, we know there's baggage that goes with all these names, but I think eventually everybody's come to terms with words.
Yeah, words have power. And Chris, I know that I have read, at least, that for some, even the term Native American is not a term that is favored right now.
Yeah, well, when it comes to these English language generalized terminologies, you got to remember that the concept of creating them came from Europe before they ever arrived here. So the earlier words were Indian, savages. But all of them, no matter which one you use, are actually all incorrect. What's in vogue with Native folks when we speak English these days, when we have to generalize, is Native with a capital N or Indigenous with a capital I. And one of the reasons it's gone away from Native American is to divorce our cultures from the idea of America, which is only a couple of hundred years old.
Mm-hmm.
So Indian is actually a legal term. The U.S. Constitution uses it. So anytime the federal government creates a law that has to do with all federally recognized tribes, that word's always going to be used. The Indian Child Welfare Act, American Indian Religious Freedom Acts, and so on. So we're not going to totally ever get rid of these words. But what I tell people is that I coach you not to use the word Indian just because of the old-fashioned nature of it. But when it comes to these terms, they are all just as wrong as each other, and not to get necessarily too hung up on it.
All right. And I want to, before we lose our time this hour, I want to talk about Maine statehood. Donald Soctoma, the reason that we're doing this program as part of a Maine history series is because this is Maine's bicentennial. What did the statehood of Maine mean to your people? Did it make a difference in any direction?
Well, I think it took a direction we didn't want it to take. The first interaction that we had with people taking our land, our concept of land ownership, we didn't have a concept of land ownership because everybody owned it. But you can't claim it, and you can't deny people access to it. So that misconception of ownership kept pushing us. And then as the population started moving into Maine, they started displacing more and more Native people. So the problems, I believe, evolved from a misunderstanding between two races of people who had different religions, who had different concepts of nature, and just different understandings about the world. That's why, as a population from Massachusetts moved up this way, we had tribe after tribe just wiped out. I think one of the last big battles was the 1724 battle on the Kennebec, where a whole, pretty much 90% of the village was wiped out by attack from the Massachusetts militia.
So, Chris, I want to have you add to what Donald said about Maine becoming a state, no longer being part of Massachusetts and becoming its own state and what that meant for indigenous people in Maine.
I would agree with Donald that it was probably, there's tons of evidence that the early part of that relationship through the 19th century was definitely on the negative side, to the point where, in the Maine Constitution and in the creation of statehood, part of the Constitution outlines the treaty obligations taken over from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with Maine's Wabanaki peoples. And then it was only a couple of decades later that the legislature chose to just not to eliminate the language, but to hide it. But it still would be enforced. So it's just not printed in the Constitution that these treaty obligations are owed by the state of Maine to Maine's Wabanaki tribes, even though they are still in effect. Statehood over the last 200 years has been somewhat of a rough and rocky road, with the state literally taking the stance that they want control of the tribes and maintaining our existence on our reservations as wards of the state rather than as human beings. And that is something that we are actively working to turn around. And a lot of efforts, generations before mine, have been doing a great job. And I think of the living heroes that I have in my life, like my father and John Stevens in our community, that really spearheaded some of these efforts back as early as the 70s.
We'll go to Richard calling from Farmington. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say my great-great-grandmother was a full-blooded Abenaki in Canton, and there was a large Indian reservation in Canton. There was one in Farmington Falls, and there was one in Norridgewock. And when someone got in trouble, they would go to one of the other villages to stay. And Farmington Falls happened to be the one that most people would go to because it was kind of in between the two other large villages. Also, you was talking about the virgin soil epidemic of 1617 to 1619. What people don't kind of connect is between 65 and 95% of the population died during that time. The pilgrims landed in November of 1620, not to a wilderness, but to an area that had been recently depopulated. And there is written accounts of people of the white people going into villages to trade for seeds and things and finding no one alive and taking anything they needed. And that's basically what surrounded the first Thanksgiving. People don't realize that, but that's what happened. There's two really good books about it. One is called The French and Indian War in Maine, and the other one's called The Hidden History of Maine.
Richard, thanks for your call. Donald, anything you'd like to add to what Richard has told us?
Yeah, it's a long history, and it's a complicated history. You can't just pick one thing and think that's going to be the whole story. I believe there were Native villages on every river, on every lake in this state, and we have a long history in this region that stretches from Nova Scotia all the way to Quebec and down in parts of New Hampshire for the Wabanaki.
Richard, thanks for your call. We just have a few minutes left, and I'm wondering, I'm going to give both you, Chris Newell, and Donald Sock-Toma, a chance to tell us about some people that you wish everybody knew about. Chris, you mentioned your dad is one of your heroes. Tell us about one or two other heroes to you.
Well, you know, some of the heroes of my life, John Stevens is somebody that, you know, should be part of the historical record of the state of Maine for what he did for us as Passamaquoddy people. This is somebody that didn't grow up speaking English, didn't have running water and electricity in his childhood, yet, formalized our government and undid an actual court case that derecognized the Passamaquoddy people in totality. The state recognized that we were there and we were not going to get going anywhere, but a court in the 19th century undid that. And he was one of the ones to lead the charge towards the Passamaquoddy Morton case, getting the lawyers involved, Don Jellers and others, get recognition returned back in the 1970s, undoing that historic wrong. So those are the people I think of, and also the culture bearers that we have. We are mourning the loss today of a Klan mother, somebody very important to the Madawbego community, Joanne Dana, and my heart goes out to all of their family, you know, and she is an example of, that living cultural knowledge that we have in our communities. We don't give PhDs for our culture. If there were one, she would have been at the highest level.
Mm. And Donald Sock-Toma, we have a little more than a minute left. Who would you like to be remembering today?
Well, especially on today, and Chris mentioned her, I'd like to remember Joanne Dana. She was a very down-to-earth woman that shared her knowledge, that had friends all over the world that everybody could go to learn something new and to get to peace with the world. She was one of a kind.
And a historic figure to remember.
Very historic. She comes from a line of what we call medicine people, healers, a direct line. All throughout our history, she comes from that line, and it's passed on to her children.
So remembering Joanne Dana today, Chris Newell, Donald Sock-Toma, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that we were really only able to talk about a very small part of such a long history. Chris, I know the Abbey Museum website has lots more information, correct?
Absolutely. Plenty on there. Educator Hub for any teachers looking for materials.
All right. Well, thank you both. Let's see. Nikki Shields was our sound engineer today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Our guests today were Donald Sock-Toma, Director of Cultural Resources for the Passamaquoddy Tribe, and Chris Newell, the Executive Director of the Abbey Museum. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.